Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Mike Saylor. How you doing, my friend?
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I've released an episode every week for about 2.5 years, but we're always really far ahead on the episode, so I've not actually done a recording for a little while. I'm feeling a little bit more nervous than usual, and I'm feeling a bit rusty, so I'll do my best for you, Mike, but I'm not making any promises.
We'll get through it.
We'll get through it. But yeah, no, there's a lot to talk about today. For the listeners that don't know you, I'm just going to do you a bit of an intro, my friend. Feel free to correct me if I get anything wrong, but you've ran and owned various different businesses. You've done a lot teaching as a professor within cybersecurity. You're currently a member of the Cybercrime Committee, North Texas Crime Commission. You've been involved with the FBI InfraGuard. You are also currently a professor of cybersecurity and digital forensics at the University of Texas at San Antonio. You're an executive director of the Cyber Defense Center and have been for almost 15 years. And you are currently the CEO of Black Swan Cybersecurity. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. That wraps it up, right?
Cool, but you sound like a very busy man. I know I've done you a bit of an intro there, but I'll start where I always start, which is, who are you, Mike? What's a day in the life like? And yeah, what do you get up to these days?
Sure. I've been in cyber IT for 30 years. I've been a professor, like you mentioned, this is my 26th year. I'm an inventor. I'm an author. I'm a writer. I wake up every morning and let the chickens out, drink coffee out in the sun, and then get to work answering phone calls and whatever comes up. I try to keep a schedule and an agenda, but to your point about being busy, my day, I have no control over how my day goes. If it's not on my calendar, good luck. And then that takes me into the evenings. So I teach most evenings. I try to spend as much time as I can with the family. But I love being outside. I have a quasi farm here with a garden and some chickens, hoping to have some cows soon. And then, so that kind of breaks up all of the cyber focused doom and gloom in the world.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, I've always thought about, you get into the stage where you can be like fully self-sufficient then. You've got your own food and solar there or something like that. Is that what you're doing?
It's solar. We have the Tesla Powerwall batteries. We have well water. I drive a cyber truck, so there's another 300 kilowatts of power if I need it. It's all good.
I've always really liked the idea of living like that, but I bet it's probably a bit more knowledge, expertise, and maybe commitment than maybe I think. Am I right?
It takes some getting used to, for sure. You can't just move out of the city and think you're going to be fine. You got to ramp up to that. It's a change.
Cool. Cool. But now, Mike, it will be nice to dive into your time over the last 30 years. It'll be nice to dive into your experience of building and running businesses, and also be interested to hear more about your books. And I'd like to learn about different things you've seen over the years when it comes to teaching people and optimizing career growth and career progression within the cybersecurity space. And perhaps that would be a nice place to start. In your experience in teaching people, is there certain types of people that tend to grow and progress and really kick forward better than others? Is there any patterns that you see that could help the listeners?
In the 26 years, I've seen everybody that is stuck to it be successful at it. And sticking to it, I think, takes a couple of different forms. There are people that get into cyber or have an interest in cyber, and then they lose interest for some reason. Maybe it's more technical than they thought it would be. The life of whatever job they were pursuing turned out to not align with their own personal goals and objectives. They can't get the job for whatever reason, so then they go back to whatever they used to be doing or find something else that seems to come up. So there's a lot of reasons why people don't end up in cyber, but there is no reason that anybody couldn't make it in cyber. There are so many different jobs and disciplines and opportunities in cyber. There is something for everybody. And what's been missing? There's a lot that's been missing as far as how do we connect this? Anybody can do it with all of the jobs that are out there. And some of the things that are missing is mentoring, career advice, internship opportunities, true alignment of the person with the opportunity. So who are you? What are your skills? What are you good at? And then from there, where do you want to go? And then filling in the gaps with all the things that you need to accomplish and do and learn and demonstrate in order to get that job. And it took quite a while to really see all of that from different perspectives. I've been the job hunter looking for jobs. I've been the educator teaching the people that want to get the job. I've been the hiring person that wants to hire those people. And I've also been on the kind of the advisory committees for how do we develop the programs and the paths to get the people in the jobs. They're all misaligned. Every one of those perspectives speaks its own language, has its own objectives, has its own title for jobs and skills. And then add to that Hollywood with everything they put on TV about all these cool cyber jobs. And now people have a misunderstanding of what that job is. And anybody, I'm going to go work in CSI and do forensics or be a hacker and all these things. And so they come into cyber with these preconceived notions of what it is and how cool it's going to be and all the money they're going to make, and they're going to be on TV and have all these friends and go to Russian raves in the middle of the night. But it's an awakening once they get into it. And I've had the privilege of working with a lot of different people, super talented, smart, amazing people, that for one reason or another, they were going to give up. It's too technical. Guess what? You're an amazing people person that understands cyber. Sure, you're not going to sit down and write code or configure a firewall or design the next bulletproof network, but you know how to manage and talk to and connect with all of these truly technical cyber people. And that is a valuable skill because those are different types of people. You can't manage a hacker dude or gal the same way you would an accountant or a marketing person. They're different people. They work different hours. They have different goals in life. It's not money and prestige. Some of it's prestige, but they want to ring the bell, but they hacked that computer. They call it popping a shell. We popped a shell, ring the bell. Or they wrote some program that does some amazing stuff. That's what they work for. They don't work for being on the face of the company newsletter or getting that $10 gift card to Starbucks, although coffee's good. So I've seen a lot. And I've come to realize a lot. And that's what drove me. So I've been a teacher for a while, and I got into teaching because I saw the need to help people or figure out a path and understand what the opportunities are. I also became a teacher because my mom was a teacher, and that inspired me. But to teach is one thing, and then to evolve as an educator, as a leader, is another thing. So it's not just I'm teaching. It's, all right, what's my role got bigger? Now I'm a mentor. My role got bigger. Now I built a company whose culture is collaboration and mentoring and sharing. And so a whole company is that way. That then drove me, along with the requirement to get my doctorate to continue teaching. And my dissertation was actually a case study on what is this cyber workforce problem. And so I did quite a bit of work on figuring out where all these different gaps are and trying to come up with a more comprehensive recommendation for fixing some of that.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Mike. And it's really interesting to hear that one of the first points you made there, which is anyone that sticks to it for long enough tends to be successful. And I think whether it's starting a cybersecurity business or becoming a great leader or breaking into cybersecurity, I think it is nice for people to get a timeline on how long things take. If you look at anyone that's phenomenal at anything, they tend to have done it again and again for a very long time. And I think in the world we live in now, everyone just wants everything yesterday.
And we see it a lot. I've interviewed people, especially younger people, that they have not even finished their training, whether that's a certification or a college course, a degree program. And they already want the job and they already want whatever the market pay is that they Googled. And they want to be able to work 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. And so just some of our interviews have turned into coaching sessions. Like, all right, just to let you know, your expectations are a little off and you don't really fit what we're looking for. However, let's take the opportunity to help level set with you and provide you some feedback. And along those lines, when you look at people's time to the job, from the time they say, I want to get into cyber to when they get the job, it's really dependent on what they put into it. And I think that's another good thing to say about cyber is not just anybody can get a job in cyber. It's those that want to put the work in. And the work could be, you've got to be on a help desk for 2 years, or you've got to go work for a church doing hardware or some nonprofit, Goodwill, doing volunteer work. Get that on your resume. Sure, it's unpaid or low pay, but that's the work you've got to put in, or go to school or get a certification or sign up as an apprentice or an intern. And we've had an intern program at the Cyber Defense Center for almost 15 years. And we've seen people put in the work and get a job in 6 weeks. We've seen people put in the time they can, maybe 5-10 hours a week, and their path is a little longer and they get a job 9 months, 15 months out. And then we get the people that come in and just think, what are you going to do for me, even though I'm here to learn from you? And those people struggle. So it really is, you'll get out of it what you put in it. But the key is to find someone to help you design your path, understand who you are, and help define those things that you've got to accomplish in order to get the job.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's interesting you said there about the people that come in and the attitude almost is, what can they get out of it, or what can I get out of it? And you said those people don't get very far. And I think that's so true. I actually just wrote a note down here that said, you just need to switch off. People just need to switch off from the end results and just focus on doing the process really well and enjoying it. And I tend to find in my own business and career that the end results do tend to look after themselves. And it's interesting you mentioned about volunteering, because I agree. I think if someone's trying to break in, they should definitely work for free at first, build some relationships. For some people, that might be a day a week, an hour a week. Some people, they might be able to work free full time if they can afford to do it. A bit like running a business as well. If you go in there with the attitude of serving and looking after the area that you are servicing, again, things tend to get good. But it's a slightly longer term approach that not everyone wants to hear that you've got this magic silver bullet answer, but it exists.
It doesn't. Tenacity, leadership is another great quality we look for in people. And there's a couple of really short books by John Maxwell. He's got some leadership books. We require our interns to read those books and actually do presentations on leadership. It really helps them do some self-evaluation. But being a leader also means you're able to leverage the strengths and weaknesses of your team. And a team of leaders is the most effective team you can have. So a leader, everybody thinks, well, that's my manager, that's the boss, that's the people that know. A leader is the people around you that actually take the initiative, that are observant, that are compassionate, that do listen, that do contribute. In our organization, there's no such thing as it's not my job. No one's allowed to say that. Everybody does what needs to get done. And I grew up that way. My mom or my parents both were, it wasn't a list of chores and who did what. It was, you guys can see what needs to get done, and we expect things to get done by the end of the day or whatever it was. And my brothers and sister and I, or actually as the whole family, we would knock stuff out and get it done. Mm-hmm. And so there's the technical aspect of cyber, but there's the human soft skills and personality traits that we look for in cyber. But I'll say it again, anybody can get a job in cyber. There is a job for everybody in cyber. There are so many things, and a lot of organizations have one person or a select few people that they make wear so many cyber hats. That's where the burnout comes from. That's where the gaps in protection and response come from, is because these people are overwhelmed with responsibility and don't have the bandwidth to maintain their skills or awareness or capability around all of that. And it's because there's a lack of awareness all the way around. There's a lack of awareness on the hiring organizations, knowing that they can find more pointed, disciplined people for that thing and not expect to pay full price, if you will, for that. Maybe that's part-time or an intern role or an admin role. And then on the job seeker side, they think, I've got to fit in this box of this job title. No, you don't. There are so many subsets of that job title to help you get your foot in the door. And maybe that's not a full-time role, but there are so many opportunities with task-oriented admin, back office stuff that's all cyber-related that people just don't talk about. They don't realize.
Yeah, no, come on. Yeah, like you say, cyber is just ridiculously broad. So I think people getting good at one particular area, and you hear about sticking to it earlier, about sticking to it and getting good. And it's surprising to me how many people don't do that. If we pick up say, not so much at the senior end, but if we pick up a mid-level vacancy, sometimes we can do upwards of 30 screening, unless we're going out to our immediate network to people we already know. But sometimes we can do upwards of 30 screening calls for, say, GRC folks. And it's amazing how many people just don't really have a strong understanding of NIST 853. And it's, you know, you'd think people would get really good at that if that's what their main area of focus is. But it's surprising that people don't. So if people are listening to this and do take this on board, if you do get really good, really focused and stick to it, you will be up there in the top percentage of people, because so many people don't, do they, Mike?
And I think that's a good example. So GRC is, you can be an amazing generalist in GRC and not be an expert in NIST 853, but I could go, yeah, I can do NIST 853. It's every other audit. Give me a week to brush up on what the objectives and controls are and how to properly scope that. I'll knock it out because I've audited everything you can think of. Can't say I've done 853, but it can't be different than 800-171 or ISO 20. So you see what I'm saying? So you can be an amazing generalist in GRC, just like you can be an amazing generalist in cyber. And so if you understand, like, to a fault, like very granularly, all the different fundamental pieces of cyber and how they all play together, at some point you're going to go, you know what? I really like security architecture. I really like vulnerability assessment. I like auditing. There's a discipline in cyber that people don't think about, to be a cybersecurity auditor, the GRC side of cyber. That is an amazing job and opportunity, and not one that requires a whole lot of experience versus I want to be a SOC analyst. That's 2 years of experience, right? That's the minimum these days, right? What if I want to be a cybersecurity GRC specialist? You just need a 4-year degree for that. Pricewaterhouse will hire you today with a 4-year degree to be a cyber auditor. You'll start at the bottom and you'll progress pretty quick. And that's the kind of feedback people need to have hope that they're going to get a job in cyber. But to your point as well, cyber is not accounting. And specifically talking about degrees or higher education, if you got a degree from accounting, if you got an accounting degree from any school in the country, or probably, I'm going to say North America, because there's different accounting standards around the world. But if you got a degree from a school in accounting, I can pretty much 95th percentile guess all of the things, concepts, and courses you took to get that degree. If you got a degree in cyber, who knows what you learned or what courses you took? Because there's not a standard yet for cyber. And cyber is so big, right? Cyber is more like a business degree, right? So you got a bachelor's in business, but your major was accounting. You got a bachelor in business, but your major was marketing. We need to do the same thing with cyber, right? You got a degree in cyber, but your focus was forensics or offensive security or defensive or architecture, or we need to do the same thing. And one of the things I found in my study was very few organizations actually put any value in a bachelor's degree in cyber because of that. I'd have to look at your transcript and call your school and have a separate interview just to figure out what you learned and what value your degree is bringing or how it aligns with this job. So I think that goes back to the misalignment. There's still all these things that we need to pull into place to make this job, this workforce flow better.
Yeah. And I agree. I think as well, it's if you did a finance degree, a balance sheet or a P&L is the same now as it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, whereas security just moved in comparison to something like finance, it just moved so quick.
Make a point there. So we deal with, in our intern program, or just in my experience, I've dealt with a lot of different types of entry-level cyber people. We have students that are in a program that want to get inside. We have transitioning military and law enforcement that learned it a certain way, and they want to get into the private sector and get a job in cyber. And then we have transitioning professionals, somebody that was in IT or accounting or some other field. We have bus drivers and construction people that want to get into cyber. And I'll go back to the accounting and finance, because that's what made me think of this, is your comment about the balance sheet. So those people will come into cyber and think, I learned cyber. I want the job. All right. What are you doing? What did you do yesterday? What are you doing today to stay current? And they're like, what are you talking about? Yeah, cyber changes every day. It's not like that balance sheet. It's not like that accounting principle that it's a standard that it's around for years before there's any update. Cyber changes every day. And that's one of the things that, going back to, you get out of it what you put into it. Some of those people self-disqualify. They're like staying updated on cyber and having to put effort in reading bulletins and newsletters every day. That's not for me. Maybe I'm going to go back to accounting. So there are several that kind of self-disqualify because they realize the level of effort and involvement and integration with media or industry groups or whatever it might be. And they're just like, yeah, that's more than I thought.
Yeah. I think you've got to be genuinely into it, Mike, haven't you? It's like you've got to enjoy that just constant thirst for knowledge. And I think some people just naturally, they actually get pretty bored if they're not learning new stuff all the time and keeping up. They find it really stimulating if they are being. But yeah, that's the type of person I think you need to be, because nothing stays the same. And I think that pace of change with, can't do a podcast without mentioning AI, but like that pace of change with everything like AI and the way things are going, I think that pace of change is just going to get faster and faster. So what you've just said is probably going to become more and more important as the years go on.
And I think a good example of that with AI is those people that have become complacent in their lives, whatever it is, they wake up and do the same thing because they love waking up and doing the same thing every day. They're going to use AI the way their friends tell them, or the way that a social media post shows them. They're not going to take the initiative to learn how to use AI on their own. They're not going to research it and how do I do better prompts, or how do I validate the results from AI? They're just going to use it like some other tool. They probably never read the manual on their new smartphone, but neither did I. Well, that's not a good example. But I think along the theme of AI, AI can do so much for in different ways, as long as you learn how it works and how to use it responsibly and appropriately, and then how to validate the results. So they'll, much like any other technology, except for basic like calculators, those are pretty accurate, right? But we've come to rely on a calculator, but we should not and have not yet come to rely on certain technologies like AI, because it's been proven to be less than 100% accurate. But there are a lot of people out there who will take AI for face value. They'll take social media for face value without doing the work of really validating the rationale and results.
Yeah, you've still got to know the area or the domain or the thing that you're using it for, because otherwise you can look rather silly rather quickly, can't you?
So I spoke recently on AI, and there were some questions. And fortunately, I had read a study that had been done years ago aligned with this question. So this question was, I've heard that the evolution of AI is going to take people's jobs. And I said, it might. And I had read this study, and the study was about how the evolution or the invention and evolution of spreadsheets impacted accounting and bookkeeping. And it was an amazing presentation, and it was done by the study, and the presentation was done by an AI guy from Google. And you had all these jobs in bookkeeping and accounting, and then someone developed this software that was a spreadsheet. And so now I can do formulas and I can input numbers, and it just does stuff. Sure, the traditional accounting and bookkeeping jobs went down, but then you see this whole spider web of other types of jobs, other specialties, other things that those bookkeepers and accountants are now qualified to do, because they all stemmed from those fundamental skills and concepts. But this spreadsheet now allows us to do other things. Like actuarial work was all pen and paper or pencil and paper, and now you can do that in spreadsheets. All right, what if I became an expert on spreadsheets? Because I understand as an actuarial or a bookkeeper how to utilize this new tool to do all these things. Now my job is setting up spreadsheets for other accountants and actuarials, right? So that's a new job that wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. And I'm no longer an actuarial. I'm the spreadsheet developer for others. So yeah, it eliminated that job, but it created this new job. And so AI, similarly, if you learn how to use AI, it's either going to help you do your job better, or could eventually, and we've seen a ton of these where people are using AI to do these new jobs, these new things. It's those people that are resistant, becoming familiar with the tool and how it would help them do their job, that are going to lose their job.
Yeah, it is. And I heard a saying, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but I think it's something along the lines of AI won't take your job, but another human using AI will. Right. Someone articulate way better than me, but yes, something along those lines. But yeah, I think I'd be interested to hear what you think, Mike. I think anyone that's like really on point, up for it, wants to carry on learning, wants to keep growing, I think AI is actually just going to, I think the next few years is going to be like really good fun for those types of people. I say, if someone's cruising, chilling, just wants to sit behind a Nessa scan and just do a bit of surface level work, that they should probably be pretty worried. But anyone that actually really wants to go below the surface level and go deep and really push forward. I think it could be like a real
time. And I think you bring up a good point, because there is a name for that person. We call them a button pusher. And so if you are a cyber person that just pushes a button and you lack the initiative to continue learning, then yeah, your time is limited, especially now in this evolution of AI and automation. There may still be a role for you, but your career advancement is significantly limited. So if I can continue that scenario, if I'm a button pusher, I still have to deal with the report on the back end. And that's the majority of the effort on a vulnerability scan. These, especially Nessus, they don't provide really valuable consumable reports at the end. So the majority of the cost associated with a vulnerability scan is having someone skilled and knowledgeable about what those results are to put those in a consumable format for the client. And consumable, it not only reduces the volume, like a Nessus scan can easily generate 15,000 pages, and a lot of which false positives, irrelevant or uninteresting findings. How do I then take all of that data and make it more concise and consumable and add charts and graphs and explain and be able to explain those findings and collaborate with the client or the consumer on what to do next? AI can help you with that. AI can take that 15,000 page Nessus report, go out to the internet and research applicable characteristics and attributes and input on those findings, consolidate them, create the charts and graphs, create the executive report, but you have to know how to use it. And then you have to know how to validate it, because I still, to this day, I can't remember what it was, but I asked Grok something, the Twitter AI Grok. I asked him something. I say him. It would be a lizard for all I know. I asked Grok, man, what was it that I asked? But the result was a hallucination. It was fabricated. Right website, no content. So just weird stuff. It still happens.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, no, you've got to. Yeah, like I say, it's good if it's used in the right way. I think everything we're talking about there, Mike, is like, it's just going deeper than the surface level. I notice it in recruitment. Like, if you try and come in and any shortcuts you try and take, or you don't build relationships properly, like the market just basically treats you accordingly. Whereas if you come in, take a long-term approach, actually genuinely listen to people, learn about their businesses, add value, really get knowledgeable about the sector, yes, it takes longer. Yes, it requires some patience. But if you do that, you look around 2, 3, 4, 5 years into the game and things are going pretty well. But it's the same whether you're breaking in, or it's the same whether you're running a cybersecurity consultancy. It's just that bit deeper. And I just find if you do all this, I just find that so many people don't. So if you are prepared to go that extra mile, I think at that end, it gets fairly easy to stand out, because most people will just never get there.
And you sparked two more thoughts. One, absolutely, even if you're unemployed, you should be doing something. So your resume, if you were let go or left your last company 2 years ago and you're interviewing now, your resume should say, what are you doing in the interim? I'm volunteering for the Information Security Association. I'm studying for this test. I built this lab in my house and I'm working on these research projects. I'm writing these white papers. I'm contributing to whatever. And that's going to demonstrate that even though there was this gap in employment, you're still top of your game. You're still plugged in. So there's that. The other thing that I think, and I've seen, and this goes back to the misalignment, is I've seen resumes where people will say, in my last job, I was a senior analyst. I was a senior engineer. Okay, tell me about that. Then their description of themselves and their skills are still entry level. They only made it to senior because they worked at that company so many years, and that's how they were rewarded. So they were promoted based on tenure, not expertise. And that's something that needs to be fixed too, because now you've set the expectation of that person that my next job is a senior engineer, because that's my title from my previous job. And so they're interviewing for these senior jobs and they're not getting them. But they're also not getting the feedback that you're not getting that job because that's not who you really are. That was just a title given to you because of your tenure. We need to level set with those job seekers too, and have a tool available for them so that they can self-realize, self-analyze. Even though they gave me senior engineer, now that I'm out in the job force, I can go reassess where I'm at. And you know what? Crap, I'm just a regular engineer. Or conversely, I've seen some too that were held back. they weren't promoted over a certain level, but their skills, they're just an amazing resource. And now they're out there looking, and maybe they didn't realize that they're that valuable either. So they're looking for this entry-level analyst or mid-level job where in actuality, they're qualified for much more.
Yeah, no, I've seen it on both sides as well. And it's true what you said, because this market's like really different. So 21 and 22 was just red hot. It was like the best market. I don't ever know if we'll see another market like that again. It was just so good. And then the last 2 years have been a bit indifferent. But I do think like the demand has always stayed. Like for the really good people that are doing all the stuff we're talking about, I think that the demand is still there now. I know from the stuff we're doing day to day within the agency that it's still there, and I think it always will be. So I think if people can really push on, it just protects you in this really crazy world that we live in right now, because it's certainly not normal, Mike, is it?
It's not. It's not. And one of the cool things about cyber is it evolves. And so every day I mentioned it, cyber changes. Well, so could your role. And at Black Swan, we allow everybody in the company to cross-train on any other discipline or opportunity that they're interested in. So an analyst can shadow someone doing forensics. An engineer can shadow someone doing an audit. And I think that's important, not only so that your perspectives and your experience is more holistic as you work on whatever that daily discipline is, whatever your current job is, but it also gives them the opportunity we go back to burnout, and there are some people that just get, I cannot read another threat report. I wish I could do something else. I wish I could help. I think one of the things I've seen also in cyber is the willingness to collaborate and help. It's not just about hacking a network. It's not just about telling an organization that they're not compliant or you've got all these problems. It's the next step. How do I help? How can I help you fix that? Who can I connect you with to help? And at least in the North Texas, I think Houston has a really good environment too. The cybersecurity community in those two areas, and I'm speaking to those because that's the ones I'm most familiar with, is so collaborative and supportive. And this will go back to anybody that wants to get into cyber, start there, go to a happy hour, go to some of these events and just say, I'm here to learn. Is there anybody that I can talk to? And you'll find a lot of support there. And even online, social media, just be careful what buttons you push and what you say. Be humble. Yeah. And you'll find some good support.
Yeah, it's so true that is. And even if we compare it to something like finance again, I don't know much about the finance community, but I don't imagine that they're as like open and as collaborative as the security community is, because I couldn't agree more. If you come in and even if your knowledge isn't very good, if you genuinely want to learn and genuinely put in the effort in and the real burning authentic passion there, I've always found people are so willing to help. And I actually think it's quite a big compliment. If you say to someone, I absolutely love what you do, I'm so interested to learn more about what you do on a day-to-day basis, it's actually one of the biggest compliments you can give someone. And people that have been in the game a while and had a bit of success, they tend to get to the stage where they actually do want to give back a bit and enjoy that side of the role. So I think it's good.
And most of those are going to tell you all the bad stuff because they want to make sure that your expectations are set appropriately. So many people want to come in and be a hacker. Okay, let me introduce you to a hacker and let you walk a day in their shoes. And they're like, yeah, I'm not good at working 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. and drinking energy drinks and eating snack food and not seeing my friends for 3 days or whatever it is. So that's an eye opener. And understanding too, that the career, like the path to becoming an independent, like you can do those engagements on your own is 5 to 8 years. And a lot of people don't want to wait that long. All right. So maybe that's my 5-year goal. What can I do tomorrow? What can I do next year? And so that at least starts the conversation and helps mentor them into some career planning. And what I found too, is if you can get people in those conversations, they're grateful because now maybe I didn't need a 4-year degree for that. So you just saved me 4 years and a ton of money. Or what I get asked a lot, Mike, what certification should I get? What job do you want? I don't know. Let's figure that out first before you go sit for all these $500 to $3,500 exams, plus all the study guide and however much time you invest in doing those things. So that certification may not end up being aligned with what, you know, the job you end up getting.
Yeah, no, definitely. Mike, I love the fact that you run an intern program, because I think so many people talk about that area of the market needing more support and needing more help. And like I said, the media love to write that there's a massive skills gap. There is, but it's not at the junior end of the market, it's at the very senior end of the market. But a lot of people talk about that problem, but not as many actually take action and do something about it. So it's nice to hear you doing that. And then on the cross training piece, that's really good because, as you're aware, everything links in so much. So I'm imagining that makes it, yes, helps with burnout and stuff like that, but I bet it helps with their core job as well. If you understand everything that's going on around you, it's never going to be a bad thing, is it?
And a lot of times when you're talking to your end user, whether it's a client or an internal user about some security thing, a lot of times they ask, why do I have to do that? Why is that important? Why did that happen? Or why does it have to be done a certain way? If you can arm your team with all these different perspectives, so it's not just about security, it's about compliance, it's about privacy. That one thing, though, may not be a critical security vulnerability or exploit, it could lead to these other things. We did an assessment for a company the other day where they had a forgot my password page on their website. And you put in your email address and it's going to send you an email to reset your password. The current best practice for that page would be just to say, if this was a valid email address, you'll get an email. But in this case, it was telling you that was a wrong email. Well, a lot of people are like, so what? Why is that a problem? Bad guys can now use that page to validate those company email addresses. Well, I can go to that page and go, mike@companya.com. It's not valid. How about msaylor@companya.com? Okay, I sent you an email. Now I know your login email or the format of your email. And so that kind of talks or touches on the why is that a problem? Because bad guys can use it to validate information to facilitate the next step in their attack. And so if you're educating those that are making the phone call about fixing a problem or addressing a problem with as much conceptual context as possible, they can have a more valuable and informed conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Having a proper hacker mindset helps. Sounds like you've got one, Mike.
I've been around the block a time or two.
Okay. All right, then. Back to the timeline. So when people are coming in, so you saw someone come in 6 weeks and land a job. Sounds like they really hit it hard, smashed it, did pretty well. And then you've seen other people take different lengths of time. What do you reckon is like a reasonable timeline to land your first job? And what's a reasonable timeline to get really good? I think you said 5 to 8 years to be doing kind of red team stuff is, I think, what you were alluding to.
It really does depend on the person and their objectives. So if they want to be an analyst, you can be an analyst in 6 months, entry-level analyst, finding the right opportunity. And there's some coaching that goes along with that. And what I mean by that is so many hiring organizations today use analytics to help get the resumes of the people that they end up interviewing. All right, so how do I get through the analytics to actually get the interview? So there's some coaching there. And some of that is, again, self-awareness. Some of that is helping them understand that the things that they are doing or have done belong on the resume. There's value to that. What value is it? And where do I put it? And how do I say it? That's going to help them get through the analytics. And I think recruiters play a role also. So a lot of job seekers will apply directly to the company, but really what they should be doing is working with a recruiter that often plays that kind of coaching role. Let me look at your resume. Let me talk to you. Maybe you've got some assessments that you can do to help find their weaknesses and their strengths so that you're better prepared in having conversations with the employers about this amazing person that you've got available and where their skills are. That's a very important role that's going to help get them in front of those hiring organizations. All right, now I'm in front of the hiring organization. That's an opportunity for you to lose. And some of those, what I've seen in a lot of cases is, and I'm going to go back to some of those important character traits, humility and leadership. If you can embody the 21, or at least as many as you can, there's 21 irrefutable laws of leadership. That's a John Maxwell book. If you can embody as many of those as you can, truly, not faking it, but truly listen, be empathetic, be humble, be real in your interview. Don't exaggerate. Be willing to say, I don't know that answer, but I am a very resourceful person and I can figure that out with no problem. I'm a good problem solver. Whatever it is, the case may be, the interview, that the person interaction, communication is very important. And then All right. The follow-up. A lot of us, and I teach this in my courses today, once the interview is over, once the test is over, once that lab, whatever it is, once it's over, you've got to go back and reevaluate. How did I do? Ask. Get feedback from the interviewer, because that's a gap in this workforce. Problem is, I don't know why I didn't get the job. I don't know how I did. I don't know why I did get the job. We've got to have that feedback loop, and we've got to pressure the hiring organizations to participate in that.
And on that point, you really have, because any organization above a certain size, they will just give feedback because they're so worried about saying or doing the wrong thing and then getting into some kind of issues. So you're absolutely right. It's like, it needs to be, you need to push for it. You need to almost get on the phone to your recruiter or whoever interviewed you and almost say, look, just please, off the record, just let me know what's what. Give me some feedback, even if it's verbally over the phone, so things aren't on email, because I know some of these larger companies are really worried about it. But you're right. And again, it goes back to just going below the surface level, actually pushing a bit more. Like, feedback's probably not going to come to an individual every single time unless they push for it, or if they're dealing with a recruiter directly. But yeah, it's so valuable. And I think as well, like, it's easy to access people these days, but everything's so noisy. So I just think people have got to, like, really go personalized, really stand out and be polite, persistent and personalized. Because I don't know what your inbox is like these days, Mike, but ever since I put the word founder on my LinkedIn profile, my inbox is bombarded. It's ridiculous. And if people don't use personalization and they're not polite and persistent, they're just not going to stand out in this day and age, you know?
And you're right. And one more thing I'll add is, I can't think, and I'm guilty of this too, I can't think of the last time I've asked somebody in an interview if they have any questions for me. What we've interviewed you this whole time. What do you have questions? What questions do you have for us about our company, our job, whatever it is? It's actually, and back to your point about asking somebody about their job, they're like, thanks you for asking. Let me tell you about my job. The people that are interviewing you will feel the same way if you ask them, how do you like working here? How long have you been here? What is your job like? What's your favorite things? And in some cases, you may even know who is going to interview you. Go do some research on them. Look at their LinkedIn page. See what groups they're a member of, where they used to work, where they went to school. Be prepared, because that's going to show some initiative, but it's also going to show your resourcefulness and research, and your ability to learn is huge in cyber. And we often, like in our organization, when we interview people, we want to know about what you do when you're not at work. What books do you read? What do you do for your hobbies? What's your home network look like? And my home network is pretty bland. I've got a router. I've got a weather station on the roof that I report weather. I've got cameras all over the place, and any number of gadgets attached. And so that seems pretty vanilla, right? But it's very secure. So that's what I would say in an interview. Tell me about your network. It's probably your typical, like, design architecture, but it's very secure. And this is what I did to secure it. So it's those types of things that are going to show who is interviewing you that you're not just here for the job. It's part of who you are, and you're just going to bring that to work.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thanks, Mike. And I think it's one of the best ways to learn is to ask people that are more senior, like, just ask them for help. And I just find most people are open to it. Even the new recruiters that we've had start recently, for us, I'm training them up from scratch, and it's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of work. But one of the things that I suggest is just reach out to really senior people, just go for it, and just ask to schedule a call, because I'm sure it'll be a mutually beneficial conversation at some stage. And if you ask people for a bit of help, I think most people, especially in the security community, I think most people's natural reaction is to give it and help out.
And I'm not suggesting stalking at all, but if you want to go work for company A, look at their LinkedIn page and find out who works there. And then for those people that are in that area that you want to go work, again, dig into their profile and see what associations they belong to or what schools, or maybe they posted that they're a part of some mountain biking club. And then just make yourself available in those venues. Go to that happy hour and introduce yourself. Have a business card printed up that's got your name and aspiring cyber person or available engineer. Don't bring your resume, but bring something that you can give them that says, I'm here to connect with you and here's how you can get a hold. And then and there's other things, you know, volunteer with those organizations, be the person that hands out the badges and say, hey, Bob from Company A, I'm glad you're here. I'm Mike. I hope maybe I can spend some time with you later to catch up. Or the best thing to do is submit to present, get up in front of people and tell them something amazing you did or some research. And that's really going to lend itself to some value there. And put that stuff out on social media too. Go read 5 or 10 or however many security bulletins you subscribe to and consolidate that into a newsletter and put that on LinkedIn. And you know what? You can use AI to do that, but make it personalize it. Don't just take AI's result, but personalize it, but let AI do the heavy lifting and put that out there. And guess what? People are going to start following you because you're doing something that they don't know how to do or like the way you do it better. And that's a great way. And you're in the job interview and go, yeah, I do a newsletter on LinkedIn every day. And you're like, that's impressive.
Yeah, no, thanks, Mark. And it's such good advice, that is. The stuff about speaking and stuff like that, it's, I think what it does for you, like the strength and depth of your character and your confidence levels as well. I can remember, I've not done one for a while now, but I used to do a lot of LinkedIn Lives. And so many people would come into these LinkedIn Lives. And literally the first one I did, I couldn't do any work for an hour before. I couldn't do any work for an hour after. It was like ruining my productivity for most afternoons. But it really did help. Like, going on a client call after doing a LinkedIn Live in front of quite a few people just felt nothing. It just felt great. It felt so easy. So I think what it actually does, and it will be the same whether it's a job interview or a client call or a scoping call or whatever it might be, if you've just come off stage at a conference, and I think all of a sudden a one-to-one meeting, whether it be virtual or in person, probably seems quite easy. And I just think it gives you such a buzz as well, I've found. It's nerve-wracking before, but afterwards it's like this super high feeling after. It's quite hard to beat.
And I think this is a good time to add that I am as far left introverted as you can be, believe it or not. I after this, even though this isn't in person, after this is over, I've got to go sit in a dark room and recharge. And I'm the same way when I come away from a presentation, whether it's at a lunch or on a stage full of, in front of a bunch of people, it is very draining for me. And I've got to go, it could take an hour for me just sitting in the car or over a cup of coffee, but it's where I wanted to be. And so a lot of people may have heard us talk about presenting and they're like, oh, there's no way I'm getting in front of people. You may just have to force yourself to figure that out. My first public speaking was in 1999 in an auditorium full of police officers about how this network compromise happened. And I was so nervous. I kept hitting the microphone. I didn't know what to do. And I was shaking and I was nervous, but I'm also I've used humor a lot in my life. That's my defense mechanism. I use humor. And so as I hit the microphone, I noticed some of the people in the audience kind of jumped up and it turned out that I was putting them to sleep. So hitting the microphone actually kept people's attention and I made a game out of it. And so there's different tools and techniques that you can use to help offset your nervousness or your hesitation to be in front of people. I think people often suggest just picture them in their underwear. And that's not what this group, this first one I did with the police officer, that was would have been a nightmare. But I had to learn how to be an extrovert in order to succeed and follow the path I wanted to be on. I just had to adjust and figure out a way to handle the energy drain and the stress. And that just goes back to finding a good mentor and a coach that'll help you figure those things out.
Cool, mate. Thanks. It's interesting to hear you talk about that speaking event because I've had other guests on before that have had not too dissimilar stories where they're great at speaking now and they come across great on the podcast like you have today, but it wasn't always that way. And I think the first time that we do anything, probably not going to be that good at it. And I think the other thing is we always notice little things we do ourselves, and I don't actually think other people do notice it as much. Or if you're putting a post out or doing a speech, I think a lot of people are probably thinking about the way they're coming across. So perhaps they don't realize, but we think in our heads that all these things matter. But if you can just keep that in mind and keep it in perspective and just go for it, I think that's the best way to make these speaking events happen, because it's so easy to overthink it and then just not take any action.
Agreed.
So cool. All right, Marcus, we come to the end here, and thanks for taking the time. I know you're mega busy. We were talking on air about this. We rearranged a few times, which I can't remember if it was mine or your fault, but I think it was mine. But I've enjoyed this chat. But I know you're an author as well, Mike. be nice to hear a brief bit about your own books, but also where do you get your information from? What are you finding has helped facilitate career growth for you?
Sure. I was pulled into authoring, like formal authoring. I've written papers and news articles and some research over the years, but the formal opportunity to become an author was in my grad school. So my graduate advisor, instead of writing a thesis, he was an author. And the first book was called Digital Crime and Digital Terrorism. And he said, Mike, I'd like you to read this book. And this was in 2011. So I was almost 20, about 18 years into my career. And he said, I'd like you to read this book and tell me where I can make it better. And so I read the book. It was 15 chapters. And I ended up giving him 160 pages of ideas. Some of my own charts and graphs I've used in presentations, a lot of research I did. And there is so much out there. You just have to dig for it. So current events, more relative, more current case studies and examples. And I gave him all that. And that was in place of having to do a thesis for my master's degree. And so he took all of that content. And so that was the third edition of his book. So when the third edition came out, chapter 5 of that book was all of my content. And that was on sophisticated cyber criminal organizations, something like that. So at the very bottom of page 5 in very small print, it says this chapter was contributed by Mike Saylor at University of Texas. And then throughout the rest of the book, he was able to use some of my charts and graphs and case studies in other areas like forensics and cyber privacy and some other things. All right. So then fast forward three years. Now, the other authors on this book were just amazing, high profile people like counterterrorism, government agents, this kind of thing. And one of those authors was in the Middle East doing research on terrorism and got hit by a suicide bomber. Like he was blown up for being who he is. So he was targeted. And because of that, the main author, Dr. Taylor, said, we lost an author. We want you to be a main author, like a named author on the book. And so I was given 3 chapters to update with current information and relevant stuff. And so just spending time connecting into the different news outlets and resource. The United Nations has a really good cybersecurity program with a lot of good global stats. All the information sharing and analysis centers across the U.S., they're called ISACs and fusion centers. I don't know if anybody can have access to that. I was privileged to be a member of some organizations that gave me access to those things. So I was a named author on the 4th edition. And then just recently, they published the 5th edition. So there's a 5th edition. But today it's called Cybercrime and Cyberterrorism. And then a few years ago, I was asked to help build the bachelor's degree program for a college. And the cybercrime class was one of those that they wanted to build. And now my book is the textbook for that class.
Yeah.
And then just the latter part of last year, I was doing a podcast with a guy. It's called The Backup Wrap Up. And he's a backup administrator to make sure organizations' data is protected and all this good stuff. And he asked me to come on and talk about cybercrime and cyber threats. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing several podcasts on different topics. He just kept asking me to come back. And then I think it was the pre-show just chatter we were having. He said, Mike, I'm writing a book on ransomware. And I'm really good at how to protect yourself with backups from ransomware, but I'm really struggling with all the cyber technical, like how to prepare and defend and detect. And just because of our interaction, he asked if I would help co-author that book. So I think we're up to chapter 7 or 8 of that book with, I think focus is 12 chapters. So we're hoping to have that done over the summer, but it'll be a book on how to respond and handle ransomware.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. And for everyone listening, I think this sort of thing is just, it's just win-win all round because it reinforces your own knowledge and others. So it's like
forces you to go out and do research and and update how current you are on certain topics. But that's also how you become an expert in a certain area. I am not an expert on ransomware by choice. I've become pretty good with handling ransomware because companies call us for incident response when they get hit with ransomware. Mm. And we're going to figure it out together. What's the best way to do this? What have I seen be successful there? What are some of the fundamental things that we've seen across all these incidents that we can put into a playbook for anybody to do And then how do we tie you in with law enforcement and other resources to help you get through this?
Yeah, cool, Mike. No, sounds interesting. And look, I know I promised you an hour. We've gone way over, so thank you again. And it's been good. Do you think we did okay? Do you think we about nailed it?
I think we did. And I think we could probably continue talking the rest of the day and still have good things to talk about.
Yeah, I'm sure we could. But yeah, thanks again, Mike. It's been good. It's been enjoyable.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.